A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about Melanie Witt, the former intelligence analyst who just pled guilty to sharing highly classified information with Iran. He wants to know what kind of damage that access might have done to US national security. And here's the thing that really caught my eye. He's asking whether it's unusual for someone with deep cultural expertise, someone the intelligence community actually values and relies on, to ideologically defect. That's a genuinely interesting question. Not just what happened, but the psychology of it.
The timing on this is remarkable because Witt's plea hearing was just 2 days ago, May 14th, in the Southern District of New York. She pled guilty to 2 counts of conspiracy to transmit national defense information to a foreign government. We're talking about someone who held a top-secret SCI clearance, sensitive compartmented information.
Which is about as high as it gets without getting into the truly exotic clearances.
And she wasn't some junior analyst fresh out of grad school. Witt was a DIA contractor, Defense Intelligence Agency, and before that she worked at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute. She taught Farsi. She was a subject matter expert on Iranian culture, language, political dynamics. The very person you'd bring in to help case officers understand who they're dealing with in Tehran.
The person who teaches our people how to think like Iranians decided to think like an Iranian.
That's the unsettling part. According to the indictment, she attended conferences in Iran, at least 2 that we know of, in 2012 and 2015, where she was cultivated by Iranian intelligence. She was apparently recruited at something called the Hollywoodism Conference in Tehran, which is this bizarre annual event where the Iranian regime brings in foreign academics and media figures to rail against Western cultural influence. It's deeply propagandistic, but it's also a known hunting ground for Iranian intelligence recruitment.
The Conference Against American Cultural Imperialism, where Iranian intelligence shops for American assets. There's a symmetry there that's almost too neat.
Almost literary, isn't it? But here's where it gets concrete. After she was recruited, Witt began providing Iranian intelligence officers with, and I'm quoting from the court documents here, information related to the identities, locations, and activities of U.S. intelligence officers and sources. She created dossiers on individual American intelligence personnel. Names, roles, assignments, operational methods.
That's not abstract policy analysis walking out the door. That's a targeting list.
And she didn't just hand over a thumb drive and walk away. The indictment describes her as having a sustained, multi-year relationship with her handlers. She met with them in Iran, she communicated with them through encrypted channels, and she continued providing information even after she left government service. The FBI arrested her in February of 2025, and she's been in custody since then.
Let's sit with the damage question first, because shared classified information can mean a lot of things. What does it actually mean when someone hands over dossiers on U.S. intelligence officers to Iranian intelligence?
The most immediate, visceral consequence is that you've just put names and faces to people whose entire professional survival depends on nobody knowing who they actually are. A case officer operating under non-official cover, a NOC, isn't just embarrassed if they're identified. They're compromised in a way that can take a decade to unwind. Every source they've ever run is now suspect. Every operation they've ever touched has to be reviewed.
That's assuming they're still alive to be reviewed.
It's not an exaggeration. Iran has a long track record of targeting dissidents and perceived threats abroad. The IRGC Quds Force has conducted operations on European soil, in South America, in Southeast Asia. If they know the identity of a U.S. intelligence officer who's been running sources inside Iran or targeting Iranian proxy networks, that officer's physical safety is at risk. Even if they're not directly targeted, their career is over. They're burned. They can never work in the field again.
The other piece that I think gets less attention is the source network. An intelligence officer is a node in a web. When you identify the officer, you don't just get the officer. You get a starting point for mapping everything they've touched.
Counterintelligence is a discipline of connecting dots. Once Iranian intelligence knows that Officer X was stationed in, say, Baku from 2018 to 2022, they can start pulling records. Who entered the country on diplomatic visas during that period, who was seen at which cafes, who made calls to which numbers. They can retroactively reconstruct an entire operation, and every source that Officer ran is now in danger of being rolled up or, worse, doubled.
Rolled up or doubled, meaning arrested or turned into a double agent feeding disinformation back to us.
And this isn't theoretical. The intelligence community has had to do damage assessments for cases like this before. Ana Montes at the Defense Intelligence Agency, who spied for Cuba for 16 years, is the classic example. After Montes was arrested, the DIA spent years trying to figure out what she'd compromised. In Witt's case, we're talking about someone who had access to human intelligence reporting, HUMINT, which means she could have identified sources who were providing information from inside Iran.
The damage cascades. First the officers, then the sources, then the operations, then the institutional trust. Because if you're a foreign national who's been feeding information to a U.S. case officer and you suddenly find out that your handler's identity was sitting in an Iranian intelligence file, you're not going to be eager to resume contact.
That's the second-order damage that's hardest to quantify. You can count the officers who need to be relocated. You can count the operations that need to be shut down. What you can't count is the potential sources who will now never come forward because they saw what happened and decided the risk wasn't worth it. The chilling effect on recruitment can last for a generation.
There's also the specific targeting angle. Witt wasn't just giving them names. The indictment says she provided information about the activities of U.S. intelligence officers. That could include what they were working on, what they were tasked with collecting, what the U.S. intelligence community's priorities were regarding Iran.
Which is essentially giving the adversary your collection plan. If Iranian counterintelligence knows what the U.S. is trying to learn about their nuclear program, their missile development, their proxy networks, they know exactly where to focus their denial and deception efforts. They can feed disinformation into those channels. They can move assets away from areas where the U.S. is looking. It's like someone handing the other team your playbook and your scouting report.
The scouting report and a list of your scouts' home addresses.
That's the metaphor, yes.
Now, the second part of the prompt, and this is where I think it gets psychologically interesting, is whether it's unusual for someone with deep cultural expertise to defect ideologically. Because Witt isn't the profile people expect. She's not a disgruntled 23-year-old who got passed over for a promotion. She's someone who spent years immersed in Iranian culture, who presumably understood the regime's nature better than almost anyone in the U.S. government.
Yet that deep understanding didn't inoculate her. It may have been the vector of infection, so to speak. There's a phenomenon that the intelligence community has been wrestling with for decades. It's sometimes called clientitis or going native, but those terms are too glib for what actually happens.
The condition where the case officer starts identifying more with the country they're assigned to than with their own.
It's well documented. The Foreign Service has entire training modules designed to prevent it. But Witt's case is different because she wasn't a case officer stationed in Tehran who gradually absorbed the perspective of the society around her. She was a cultural expert. Her professional identity was built on understanding Iran from the inside, on being able to see the world through Iranian eyes. That's a different psychological dynamic than a diplomat who's been at post too long.
It's the difference between someone who learns to speak a language fluently and someone who's a linguist. The linguist doesn't just speak the language. They understand its structure, its poetry, its idioms, the way it shapes thought. Witt was a linguist of Iranian political culture.
If you spend your career arguing inside the U.S. government that Iran is more rational, more sophisticated, more strategically coherent than your colleagues believe, which, by the way, is often a correct and valuable analytical perspective, there's a risk that you start to see yourself as the defender of Iran against American misunderstanding.
The advocate, not the analyst.
And once you're in an advocacy role, even in your own head, the ethical guardrails can shift. You're no longer evaluating Iranian actions through an American national security lens. You're explaining them, contextualizing them, justifying them. The Iranian regime is very sophisticated about exploiting this. They don't recruit people by saying, "Betray your country." They recruit people by saying, "You're the only one who truly understands us, and we need your help to prevent a catastrophic misunderstanding between our nations."
That's a much more seductive pitch.
It's the same playbook they used with several other cases. There was a case in 2019, Monica Witt, no relation, interestingly enough, a former Air Force counterintelligence specialist who defected to Iran and appeared at that same Hollywoodism conference. She was indicted for revealing classified information about a U.S. intelligence program. The Iranian regime has a pattern of identifying Americans who have demonstrated sympathy or deep cultural engagement and methodically cultivating them.
Is it unusual, or is it a recognized occupational hazard?
I'd say it's unusual in absolute terms. The number of cleared personnel who actually commit espionage is vanishingly small relative to the millions who hold clearances. But it's a recognized pattern within that tiny subset. The CII's own studies on insider threats have identified what they call the zealot, or ideological pathway, as one of the primary motivations for espionage, alongside money, ego, and coercion. And the ideological defector is often the hardest to catch, because they don't have the behavioral indicators you'd see with someone who's being blackmailed or who's suddenly living beyond their means.
No sudden purchases of sports cars.
No gambling debts, no affairs, just a slow, internal realignment of loyalties that's incredibly difficult to detect from the outside. Witt continued to work as a cleared contractor for years while maintaining her relationship with Iranian intelligence. She passed multiple periodic reinvestigations. The system is designed to catch the person who's suddenly in financial distress or who's developed a substance abuse problem. It's much less effective at catching the person who's decided, as a matter of conscience, that they're serving a higher purpose.
That gets to something that I think is underexplored in these discussions. The word defect implies a clean break. You leave one side and join the other. But what if the psychology is less binary? What if someone like Witt believed she was actually serving American interests by helping Iran understand American intentions better, by preventing miscalculation, by being a bridge?
That's almost certainly how she rationalized it, at least initially. I'm not harming the United States, I'm preventing a war. The problem is that once you've crossed the line into sharing classified information with a foreign intelligence service, you're no longer in control of how that information is used. You can tell yourself you're building bridges, but you're actually handing ammunition to a regime that has, as a stated policy, the objective of expelling American influence from the Middle East.
The regime's definition of building bridges is probably not yours.
Their definition of a bridge is something you walk across to get to the other side, and once you're on their side, the bridge gets burned.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the Hollywoodism conference. This is a conference about the evils of American cultural imperialism. That's the recruitment venue. And the person they recruited is someone who spent her career teaching Americans how to understand Iranian culture. There's something almost poetic about the fact that the regime's ideological appeal worked on the one person who should have been most inoculated against it.
Should have been, but maybe that's exactly backwards. The historian Richard Hofstadter wrote about this in a totally different context. He called it the paranoid style in American politics. But there's a broader point about expertise and vulnerability. The expert can become so invested in the complexity and sophistication of their subject that they lose the ability to make simple moral judgments about it. You can't condemn the Iranian regime's actions because you've spent 20 years explaining why those actions are rational responses to specific historical circumstances.
Everything becomes explicable, and explicable slides into excusable, and excusable slides into defensible.
That's the slope. And it's greased with a genuine intellectual virtue, the refusal to reduce complex realities to simple good versus evil narratives. That refusal is what makes someone a good analyst. It's also what makes them vulnerable to a recruitment pitch that says, "You're too sophisticated to fall for your own country's propaganda."
It's flattery aimed at the analytical ego.
The most effective kind.
Let's talk about the broader intelligence community question. Daniel's prompt asks whether this is unusual. People with deep cultural knowledge ideologically defecting. I think the answer is that it's unusual in frequency, but not in pattern. The pattern is well established enough that it has a name, or several names. What are some of the historical parallels?
The most famous is probably Kim Philby and the Cambridge Five, though that's a slightly different dynamic. They were recruited as students before they had any real expertise. The closer parallel might be someone like Larry Wu Taichin, a CII Chinese language translator who spied for China for over 30 years. He wasn't an analyst, but he was a cultural insider who used his linguistic and cultural expertise to facilitate espionage. He was arrested in 1985 and committed suicide in prison. He passed periodic polygraphs. He was trusted. And his access was enormous because he was the person translating sensitive documents and interpreting for high-level meetings. The cultural expert has a unique kind of access that the generalist case officer doesn't. They're in the room when the most sensitive discussions are happening because they're the only ones who can bridge the linguistic and cultural gap.
That's what makes Witt's case significant, beyond the immediate damage. It forces the intelligence community to confront an uncomfortable question. Is there something about the very qualities that make someone a great cultural expert that also makes them a heightened security risk?
The community has been wrestling with this for years, and there's no clean answer. On one hand, you absolutely need people with deep cultural and linguistic expertise. You cannot run effective intelligence operations against a target like Iran without people who understand the language, the religion, the history, the social dynamics, the factional politics. You need people who can tell you the difference between a mainstream conservative cleric in Guam and a hardline IRGC ideologue, and why that distinction matters for U.S. policy.
Those people, by definition, have spent years immersed in the culture they're analyzing. They probably have Iranian friends. They probably admire aspects of Persian civilization, which, by the way, is admirable. Persian poetry, Persian art, Persian philosophy. These are real things worth admiring.
And the Iranian regime is very skilled at using that cultural pride as a recruitment tool. They position themselves as the defenders of Persian civilization against Western cultural imperialism, even though they're an Islamist regime that has systematically suppressed large swaths of Persian cultural expression. It's a deeply cynical manipulation, but it works because it taps into something genuine.
What does the intelligence community do about this? You can't solve it by only hiring people who hate the country they're analyzing. That would produce terrible intelligence.
An analyst who hates Iran isn't going to give you nuanced, actionable intelligence about Iranian decision-making. They're going to give you caricatures. And policymakers who act on caricatures make catastrophic mistakes. We have several decades of evidence for that.
The Iraq WND failure being Exhibit A.
The intelligence community's post-Iraq reforms were largely about combating groupthink and encouraging analytical rigor, including the ability to see the world from the adversary's perspective. That's a core analytical skill. But Witt's case shows the dark side of that skill. The ability to see the world from the adversary's perspective can slide into seeing the adversary's perspective as more legitimate than your own government's.
It's the empathy trap. Empathy is an analytical tool, but it's also an emotional experience. And emotional experiences can change your loyalties in ways that analytical frameworks can't capture.
That's beautifully put. And it's not something that polygraphs or background checks are designed to detect. How do you measure whether someone's empathetic understanding of Iran has crossed the line into identification with Iran? There's no test for that.
There's also the question of whether the intelligence community's own culture contributes to this. If you're an Iran expert inside the US government, you'll probably be spending a lot of your time arguing against people who see Iran as a monolithic evil actor. You're constantly pushing back against simplistic narratives. That can create a kind of bunker mentality. It's you and your small group of fellow experts against the institutional ignorance. And that's exactly the kind of social dynamic that makes people vulnerable to outside appeals.
The outsider solidarity. They don't understand us here, and they don't understand Iran. We're the only ones who see clearly. If you feel alienated from your own institution, and then a foreign intelligence service comes along and says you're right, your colleagues are wrong, and we value your insight, that's a powerful psychological lure.
Witt, by all accounts, had a certain amount of professional friction. She wasn't a team player in the conventional sense. She had strong opinions about U.S. policy toward Iran, and wasn't shy about expressing them. That's not a crime. Strong opinions are common in the analytical community. But it can be an indicator of the kind of alienation that makes someone receptive to a foreign pitch.
There's a term in counterintelligence, MICE, the acronym for the four classic motivations for espionage: money, ideology, compromise, and ego. Wit appears to be primarily an ideology case, but with a significant ego component. The ideology gave her the justification, but the ego, the sense that she was uniquely positioned to understand and mediate between two worlds, is what made the pitch land.
Money, ideology, compromise, ego. And the ideological cases are the ones that are hardest to deter because the person doesn't think they're doing anything wrong. You can't deter someone from doing what they believe is morally correct.
Deterrence depends on the target calculating that the costs outweigh the benefits. But if you believe you're serving a higher moral purpose, costs become irrelevant or even a proof of your commitment.
Where does this leave us in terms of national security? What's the actual damage assessment look like, and what should the intelligence community be doing differently?
The damage assessment is ongoing, and we may never know the full scope, but we can make some informed inferences. Wit had access to human reporting, that's human intelligence, information from human sources. She had access to the identities of U.S. intelligence officers, which I mentioned. And she had access to what's called sources and methods, how the U.S. collects intelligence on Iran, which technical capabilities are being used, which human networks are in place.
Sources and methods is the crown jewels. The content of a particular intelligence report might be important today and irrelevant tomorrow. But knowing how the report was produced, that's durable. That lets the adversary systematically defeat your collection capabilities.
Iran has proven to be an extremely capable counterintelligence adversary. They've rolled up multiple CII networks inside Iran over the past decade. In 2011, the CII suffered what was described as one of the worst setbacks in agency history when Iranian counterintelligence identified and arrested a network of informants that had been providing information on Iran's nuclear program. The damage from that single compromise took years to recover from.
That was before Wit's compromise.
So you have an already capable Iranian counterintelligence apparatus that now potentially has detailed information about how U.S. intelligence targets Iran, who does the targeting, and what methods they use. That's a force multiplier for Iranian security services.
The other dimension I haven't heard much discussion of is the Allied impact. The U.S. doesn't operate against Iran unilaterally. There's significant intelligence cooperation with Israel, with Gulf states, with European partners. If Wit had access to information that touched on those relationships, the damage extends beyond U.S. unilateral capabilities.
That's an excellent point, and one that's probably being discussed at very high levels behind closed doors. The Five Eyes relationship and other intelligence sharing arrangements depend on trust that shared information will be protected. When a cleared U.S. person compromises that information, it can have a chilling effect on what partners are willing to share going forward.
Iran has a particular interest in understanding the intelligence relationships between the U.S. and Israel. That's a high priority target for them.
Anything that illuminates how the U.S. and Israel coordinate on Iran, what information is shared, through what channels, at what level of specificity, is of enormous value to Tehran. And Wit, given her expertise and her access, was well positioned to provide that kind of insight.
Let's try to answer the prompt's core question directly. Is it unusual for someone with deep cultural expertise to ideologically defect? I'd say it's unusual in terms of raw numbers. Most cultural experts don't defect. But it's a recognized and recurring enough pattern that it shouldn't surprise us when it happens. The very qualities that make someone good at understanding the adversary can, under the right conditions, make them vulnerable to the adversary's appeals.
I'd add that the pattern is probably undercounted. We know about the cases that get caught and prosecuted. We don't know about the cases where the defection was ideological, but the person never actually passed classified information. They just became internally hostile to U.S. policy in ways that degraded their analytical objectivity. That's not a crime, but it's a security concern.
The silent defection. The person who still shows up to work but has mentally switched sides.
In some ways, that's more damaging than the person who actively spies. The active spy can be caught. The silent defector just produces subtly biased analysis for 30 years and retires with a pension.
Which is a deeply uncomfortable thought.
And it's one that the intelligence community doesn't have a good answer for, because the alternative, ideological screening, loyalty tests, demanding that analysts demonstrate the right kind of political opinions, would destroy analytical integrity far more thoroughly than a handful of ideological defectors ever could.
That's the paradox at the heart of this. The same openness that makes good analysis possible is what creates the vulnerability. You can't have one without the other.
You can't. The best you can do is acknowledge the risk. Train people to recognize the psychological dynamics that can lead to ideological compromise and maintain robust insider threat programs that look for behavioral indicators. But you're never going to eliminate the risk entirely. Human beings are complicated.
Some of them, it turns out, are more complicated than the security clearance process is designed to handle.
Melanie Witt is going to be sentenced later this year. She's facing up to 20 years. And somewhere in the intelligence community, there's a counterintelligence officer whose full-time job for the next several years is going to be figuring out exactly what she compromised and how to recover from it.
The cleanup crew always has the hardest job.
And their work never makes the news.
To wrap this up, the damage from Witt's compromise is multi-layered. Direct compromise of officer identities and source networks. Exposure of collection methods and intelligence priorities. Potential chilling effect on allied intelligence sharing. And the intangible but real cost of demonstrating to Iran exactly how the US targets their regime. The ideological defection pattern is uncommon but not surprising, and the cultural expert's psychological vulnerability is a known challenge that the intelligence community has never fully solved, because solving it completely would require sacrificing the analytical depth that makes the community effective in the first place.
That's a good summary. I'd only add that there's a broader lesson here about the nature of insider threats. We tend to focus on the technological dimension. Better monitoring of classified networks, better access controls, better auditing. And those are important. But Witt's case is a reminder that the human dimension is always going to be the hardest to secure. The mind is the ultimate insider threat.
The mind is the ultimate insider threat. I'd put that on a poster if it weren't so unsettling.
Maybe skip the poster. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Aztec board game Patoli used a scoring system based on 5 dried beans with holes drilled in one side, and the complete rules were nearly lost to history until a set of 16th century Spanish colonial manuscripts preserved them, manuscripts that had themselves been lost for 3 centuries in a monastery archive in Seville. The beans were thrown like dice, and the number of beans landing with holes facing up determined how many spaces a player moved, but the exact scoring combinations remained hotly debated among archaeologists until 2019, when a team at the University of the Americas in Puebla discovered a previously uncatalogued codex fragment that confirmed the original bean count system.
Beans and codex fragments. The high-stakes world of Mesoamerican board game archaeology.
Now I need to know if anyone's tried to play Patoli with modern components. I have questions.
You always do. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for the fact and for keeping this operation running. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review if you're so inclined. It helps.
We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.